Hi, my name is Anton Pichka. I'm a outdoor athlete from Boulder, Colorado. And I guess we're here today to talk about a combination bike, run, climb, bike packing tour I went on this past summer.
Tony, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Buzz.
We're doing this in person. I think I've gotten a little bored. I think maybe you have too. The whole online thing, we do the podcasts. Of course, it's kind of fun to get to do it with people in Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom. But we're doing this one in person. This is, I don't know, I'm kind of a person-to-person guy.
Yeah, and we live in the same town, Boulder. So it makes sense to do it in person if the schedule works out.
So, it does. Yeah. So you were our very first podcast guest.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Number one, and I'm going to put links to this in the written show notes. So if people want to listen to this, go back, and we'll see how Tony has changed over the years. And you were our 127th guest just last year, too.
Okay. What are we at now, like 200?
I think we're about at 176 or
okay.
So.
Okay. Wow. Jeez. All right.
Yeah. So like you said, we're going to talk about this massive trip that you did, partially on bike and partially, obviously, running hiking last year, which you called Sagebrush to Summits.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I would say for the past 4 years, 5 years now, I've really gotten excited about bike touring as a way of getting outside and seeing the world. And really, the idea is just strap some camping gear to your bicycle and go cover some ground. And, but, you know, I'm best known as a mountain runner, I would say. And that's been my sport for the past 20 plus years. And, so for when I'm on a bike tour through the mountains, I'm always dissatisfied if I'm just pedaling past the base of the mountain and there's a high peak up there. So I like to bring running shoes along sometimes and climb some mountains along the way too. So that was kind of the goal of this trip, to pick a number of summits, a lot of that I hadn't done before, and go on a long bike tour and tag each mountain.
You did it all. So we better explain this, because I knew you were doing something until I looked at your article. By the way, links in the written show notes. This was a stunning trip. Let's just break it down here. You started from your house.
Yeah, so I started here in Boulder from my front doorstep. And the idea was to link together Kins Peak in the Uinta Mountains in Utah. It's the high point of Utah. The Grand Teton in Wyoming. Obviously one of the most iconic peaks really in the lower 48. And then up to Granite Peak in the Beartooth Mountains in southern Montana, which is the high point of Montana. And then over to the Bighorn Mountains back in Wyoming to Cloud Peak, which is the highest mountain in that range. And then back across the state to the Wind River Range to the high point of Wyoming, Granite Peak. And then finally ride my bike back to Colorado and finish up on Long's Peak, which is our backyard 14er here in Boulder, Colorado. I think the best 14er in the state, not just because it's in our backyard, but because it's the most technical mountain in the state.
By far.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the idea. It ended up being over 2,300 miles total. And it took me exactly 21 days door to door. And, yeah.
Wow. I mean, those are six classic summits. Like you said, the highest mountain in the Uintas,
mm-hmm.
and in Utah for that matter,
yeah.
and the highest mountain in Wyoming, the highest mountain in Montana, plus, you know, three
other like range high points, really.
Range high points. And you biked between them all.
Yes.
And you went, obviously, solo and self-supported.
Yeah. That's
a big deal right now, really, because it's really different if someone's following you in a Sprinter van, getting in your nice bed and someone's fixing your flat tires.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, I don't know. So for me, I didn't have any, great political mission with it. You know, I wasn't trying to like end climate change or something by pedaling a bicycle instead of driving a car. I think when you set an objective for yourself, or when I set an objective for myself, I'm really trying to create an experience that's going to end up being meaningful for me and putting me in situations that kind of force me into sort of a headspace and, I don't know, an orientation to your surroundings that you don't get in everyday life when you have a nice bed and a kitchen and a bathroom and, you know, shelter and that kind of thing. And so having some kind of sag wagon or having really even like a partner along the way, you know, someone to like share the miles with, would be a completely different experience that I guess I'm just not as inspired by or interested in having. Part of that's personality, but a lot of it is what I was talking about going out there for a certain type of experience.
You were out there.
It felt that way at times, yeah. Yeah, it's funny how quickly it can feel that way. Like for me, the first day I rode over the Continental Divide over Rollins Pass and got almost a steamboat, Colorado, and whatever, like that was a long day. But then the second day I went through the northwest corner of the state out to almost the Flaming Gorge of the Green River. And immediately, that's a desolate part of the country. It's bleak, desert, pretty grim. It was almost 100 degrees that day in July. You feel pretty out there pretty quickly. And I was carrying 4 liters of water and, you know, it was, I think, 150 miles without resupply. So I had like 10 burritos in my frame bag. And I don't know. It's funny. I remember also I was just like just getting into the rhythm of the trip that second day. So it felt like pretty desperate right off the bat just because there weren't many people and you just feel alone really quickly. And I remember thinking or getting excited when there would be like a highway sign, just like, you know, a curve in the road or like,
wow, look at this.
Yeah. Like exactly like a speed limit sign or something. It's like, oh yeah.
Something to occupy your mind.
Well, no, more just like there are humans, you know, and it's just funny how quickly you feel like you're out there all by yourself, I guess. And that can be unsettling, I suppose.
Well, I like this because we contrast it right away with a race where everything's prescribed. We've talked about this before. FKT versus race. In a race, this time, this date, this course, yeah. Here's food every 10 miles. If you sprain your ankle, we're going to pick you up and we're going to take you home. And this is literally the opposite. Sure. Everything is self-created. And that extends remarkably far, shall we say, into your psyche. Because also self-created is the motivation to do it, the meaning for doing it, and your own thoughts. Because if you're in a race, it's like it's all kind of coming at you. And it's a very, what's the word, a very simplistic train of thought.
Well, a race, it's a curated, created experience for you. You know, it's like, here's structure. Here, you kind of like know what you're going to be getting into. And there's some emotional comfort in that. Like, I totally understand the appeal of that. But something that I, when I create kind of a trip or an expedition or an objective for myself, it's because I don't want that, I don't know, like community aspect that, yeah, like that created aspect. Like I want to like, kind of like go out into the world, let myself be open to what's thrown at me and then hopefully rise to the occasion. And, I mean, it's creating the elements required for to like bring about some kind of radical self-reliance in yourself, you know.
Wow.
And in a race, it's almost like you intentionally take that stuff away. Like you have a crew typically. There's aid stations. There's medical personnel. There's you have often in North America. There's pacers. You know, that kind of thing. And the whole point of this is to go out there and do it yourself. And I mean, for me, that's twofold, I guess. And this is like the whole purpose of a trip like this is to go out there and get humbled, you know, feel really small in the face of kind of a giant objective and a giant landscape and, an imposing kind of intimidating landscape. And then, but also I guess every day having to like overcome a significant challenge, you gradually are empowered by the whole experience too. So it's this this dichotomy between feeling insignificant and humbled, but then also feeling kind of your authority and your agency and your, you know, like fully engaging with and inhabiting your life.
That was very articulate. Thank you. I've done a few things like this myself. I don't think I've been able to articulate it quite like that. I like it. I get it. Because in a race, or actually, if you're even just in training now, the metrics, of course, have just blown up. I mean, I'm this old guy. I said, I want to try to stay with it. So I read some of these articles. I go, I'm not sure if I want to stay with this stuff. And they're getting into this level of detail of training plans and metrics, such as your heart rate fluctuations, your glucose levels, et cetera, et cetera. And you're just blowing all that away. You're on a different scale.
Well, I'm guilty of being aware of that stuff. And, you know, I think I have a bit of a reputation for kind of meticulously tracking a lot of data with regard to my outdoor pursuits. You know, just like number of times I've done a peak or a route, number of miles per week, hours per week, vert per week, that kind of thing, you know, added up ad infinitum over the years, decades. So I'm not someone who's like, oh yeah, just go by feel and all that. Because I've had periods in my life where, and I have tracked splits sort of obsessively. But, you know, when you're talking about a race and data, anytime I've ever been in a race and I've looked at my watch and I've seen a split, it's done nothing to affect what kind of effort I'm putting out.
All right.
It's just sort of like noise. It doesn't, like, I'm already doing what I can do in the moment.
Right.
Seeing what my split is at a certain aid station or time check of some kind, it's never like changed. Okay, I need to run harder now. No, that's never been the case. It's just been like, well, I guess that's how I'm doing. You know what I mean? Like it's a weird, I don't know. So like all the data stuff is, it's interesting in retrospect always, but in the moment, it never has any bearing on my ability to like, yeah, put out an effort, I guess.
It's really helped me with training.
It's helped you with training?
Yeah, the watch.
Okay.
Strava.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm out there because I'm 99% of the time by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at my watch and said, okay, I'm doing X. Now, here's my pace. I want to get it to such and such. And so it's giving me this little bit of feedback. It's giving me someone to talk to in a certain sense.
See, that's what I like about Strava. It's by far my favorite social media app.
Right.
Because that's what it is ultimately. But that's what public training logs have always been for me. I have a private training log too, but I've been a part of public training logs since being a collegiate runner. And I've always really enjoyed them. And Strava's just been like the adult version of that for me.
Right. Social media for athletes. You get to post photos and routes. Of course, you can download.
Just see what your friends are up to, basically. Like that's like, you can get inspired by it. At least that's what it is for me.
Right. You can download GPX files for that matter.
Yeah, but what do you do with a GPX file? I've never downloaded a GPX file from Strava for like personal use.
Oh, interesting. Of course, I'm being in the business, I've downloaded 50 of them because we have to check people.
Sure. For like FKT stuff. But I mean, that goes back to like, yeah.
Right, verification.
You know, yeah, verification and trying to beat people, I guess, you know, like that's...
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Oh, this is so funny. But then like you say, you bump to a race and it's like, no, I'm just trying to beat the person next to me. I mean, you know, it's kind of like screw pace.
But why are you trying to beat the person next to you? That's what's interesting to me.
Primal. I mean, either you feel that or you don't, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have, my entire life, I've had a strong competitive urge, I guess. And, but, you know, this, I don't know what, last 4 or 5 years, I've only raced once, you know, this past summer in August. But I, you know, in the running realm, I've done bike races and ski mountaineering races. But I'm not very good at either skiing or biking. Like good enough in the front half of the pack, but not to garner any kind of recognition or accolades, you know. But I've still found those competitions to be just as enriching and valuable life experiences as any race that I've won, I guess, or where I'm contending for the win. So it's, I don't know, my motivation... I don't know if 10 years ago I would have said that winning a race is irrelevant to the experience, but that's definitely the way I feel now. yeah, sure, it's a happy byproduct or outcome, but it doesn't, I don't think it says anything about me. It's, what is much more important to me is if I can feel good about the effort that I gave that day. So.
Right. Yeah. You want to walk into the race feeling prepared.
Absolutely. Yes.
And then you want to have a good day. I mean, yeah. If something goes bad, if your stomach goes bad, it's just not a satisfying experience.
Well, I disagree with that, actually.
Really? You're okay with that?
I wouldn't have been, like I said, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But now it's like, why do you do something silly like try and run 100 miles? Because it's this irrational challenge, I think. You know, it's outlandish. It makes no sense. There's no logic to it. It's simply something that you know is going to be really difficult, and I want to find out if I have it in me to meet that challenge. Because I think there is something redeeming about taking on an elective challenge and like rising to the occasion. And there's also like, you know, like endorphins are released. But anyways, so when hardships happen along the way, if you get disappointed in the hardship, like that's just
part of the game.
Like, what's that?
Part of the game.
That's the whole point of the game. Like you're there to do this because it's a hard thing, you know? So if you're getting upset that it's hard, that seems weird.
Is there a book in your future? This is very philosophical. You're really quite articulate about this. Here I am.
I think there's a book in my future at some point, but yeah, I don't know.
That's good. Yeah. Good. I think people would appreciate that. I'm learning right now. I mean, I just, when I get in a race, I kind of want, you know, to feel tired. You know, I want to just go hard and be limited by this physical limits. And I want to feel that emotional push.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That there's something about the emotional part to me.
I 100% agree.
That's more interesting than anything else. Okay, what does this feel like? Why do I care about this? And what does this really mean? Maybe it's, you know, just have the Buddhist point of view. Like, hey, I'm breathing hard. My legs are tired. So what? It's just sensation, et cetera, et cetera. But then if I'm throwing up or something, it's like, I don't really like that. And of course, the injury thing, I really don't like getting injured. I just kind of go to pieces when I get injured.
Well, that's different. That's a completely different. Oh, okay. That's like a failure of your, you know, musculoskeletal system.
Okay.
No, I'm not interested in that either.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, I thought you had risen above that. It's like,
No. I'm not that enlightened, Buzz. No, it's more that the whole, I think... Yeah, there are two levels to it. One of them is this emotional level of I need the person in front of me to be pulling me along. I need the person behind me to be pushing me to be at my best, to kind of like drive me to my best effort. Because there is something very gratifying about being able to deliver what feels like a personally high quality performance, right?
Right.
And again, like those external stimuli. Are important for getting the best out of yourself, but comparing yourself to the other folks.
Well, that's interesting.
Doesn't matter as much to me anymore.
Right. But to tease that apart, this is very interesting, isn't it? Because I'm very, very internally motivated. I'm kind of known for just being very introverted, internally motivated for everything I do. But if I'm in a race, I want to beat the person next to me. Period. But I'm not sure.
But that's sort of like the game, though.
It is. Like, I don't think I'm comparing myself.
Okay.
You see what I mean? There's a slight difference there. Somehow,
yeah.
If someone's in front of me, I want to pass them. And I don't even know why.
It's the primal thing, you know? And, right. But I think that is an emotionally mature perspective or like position to have on the whole competitive experience. Certainly for me, there used to be like... It was just like I did want to beat the person to beat them, you know, not necessarily to get the best on myself, but to like beat my chest basically and be like, oh, I am somehow better than them, you know, and I just don't feel that way as much anymore. I think it's because that's socially looked down upon, but for good reason, because it's ultimately like self-destructive, you know, it's what's the point in tearing someone else up it doesn't build you up, it tears you down too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the sport of the running, we're really good about this. You look at some other sports and the competition can get a little nasty. In the sport of running, at least in my experience, people give the big hug, give the big high five afterwards.
Okay. I don't know.
Maybe not.
I'm cynical about human intentions, I guess.
You think that's all for show?
No, I think a lot of it is. I think a lot of it, like people like to think that just because someone's a runner, that they're somehow like an enlightened or interesting or elevated or better human. And nah, there's plenty of runners who are assholes too. And I'm probably one of them a lot of the time, you know? And so I don't know. I don't think simply going for a run makes you a good person.
No, I didn't quite say that.
I know. You're right. I put those words in your mouth.
But here's a good example, bringing us somewhat back to our original topic here, biking and running.
Okay. Yes. This trip I did.
Right. That was a very good tangent. I really liked that a lot. So just kind of roping it back in a little bit, biking and running. We've both raced bikes. We've raced on running. It's a different culture.
It is. And
now gravel is much more similar to runners. But if you get in a road race, it's way different than a running race.
Yeah, and I've never really done a road race. Ah. There's the whole trope of roadie culture and kind of the attitude and personalities that permeates that culture. And I just don't have any experience with that, so I can't really speak to it. But sort of one of the downsides of bike culture in general is that there is this necessary material good involved that is a barrier to entry, because like a faster bike will make you a faster racer, will make you a faster rider, you know? So it'll change your experience positively or negatively.
This is true. And of course, at gravel racing, there's a big controversy there right now of team.
Sure, exactly.
Team tactics are coming into it. You go to the roadie culture, and
aerodynamics are even more important on the road than
gravel. Yeah, and basically.
Well, that's the only reason that teams are important is because aerodynamics, drafting.
And the mechanics and the tactics.
All that stuff, yeah.
And it basically failed in the United States. I mean, it failed. Tour de California, Tour de Utah.
Oh, road racing. Yeah, it's
closed.
It's done.
They shut. It literally failed while still going very, very strong in Europe. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, gravel, which we invented, is now being exported to Europe, where they didn't, up until last year, do things like that. But now there's a little bit of team tactics coming into gravel, and people are kind of going, not sure what I think about that.
Yeah. I don't want to like throw a wet towel and all this, but I just don't care about any of this stuff. Like, it's just like, it's again, you know, I mean, we started this conversation. I'm very like, I pay a lot of attention to it, but ultimately I don't feel like it affects me in any way. And like, I don't, it doesn't affect, like, I can choose to ride my bike however I want, wherever I want, whenever I want, you know? And, so why would I get stressed or waste emotional energy on these other issues, you know, like, aero bars or, you know, people drafting or, you know, people, all that. It's like, I don't know, like, that's why you go out on a solo 3-week tour and, you know, have a vision quest.
As the thru hikers say, hike your own hike.
Exactly. No, it's
the bottom line.
Yeah, it's a cliche, but there's a lot of truth to it. And
right.
you have to do the things that feel meaningful to you and have some kind of resonance with your personal values, I guess.
I particularly relate, Tony, to that constant, speaking of tropes, the constant one that comes around every few years about, oh, the sport is changing.
Yeah.
They love this. It was the good old days. Now it's changing, of course. That happens like every 5 years.
Yeah.
So whatever they said, you know,
same whenever there's a new wave of people coming in.
They say, oh, it was great when I got here, but now it's going to heck. But the answer is always the same. The sport becomes whatever you make it. It's whatever you
do. Well, there's that, there's always a new generation. There's always going to be change. It's whatever you want it to be, I guess. Like exert some agency, you know? Like, like take some ownership over your experience. Don't whine about it so much.
Oh, this is good. I like that. Exert some agency. Take ownership over your experience. Okay, we have our quote for the written show notes. Thank you. Appreciate that. Because it's true. It's good advice.
Thanks. I mean, I believe it, I guess.
Yeah, and you did that with your giant tour here. So going back to that, I really liked what you were saying about that inner experience becomes really available when there's nothing else out there. You're left, just like with practice and meditation.
Yeah, I mean...
You tend to strip away externals. The meditation courses I've done, mm-hmm. you're not allowed to bring a book. You're not allowed to bring a journal.
Sure.
You're not allowed to bring anything because it wants to be a clean, pure experience. You're just left with what is real, what is there. And a trip like this sort of provides that opportunity.
It does. You know, I listen to a lot of music and podcasts on the bike. But when you're riding your bike 10 or 12 hours a day for 3 weeks on end, you're not able to occupy your mind with that stuff that entire time. Maybe half that time you are. So that still leaves you another like 5 or 6 hours every day where you're just like completely inside your head. And you realize very quickly that if you don't learn how to be content with the present moment, it's an impossible quest because you can't spend hours on end pining, pining for something to be over with. Yeah.
This is a very good point. There's a certain distance where goal orientation starts to break down, practically speaking.
Or it's just like you have to learn like contentment in the moment. Otherwise, you know, otherwise the headwind or the hill or the washboard or whatever is going to feel endless always. You just have to like accept kind of like your inadequacy, your fragility, and just be like, well, this is all the faster I can go. It might be 6 miles an hour on a bicycle, you know, but if I just keep doing this, sometime it will end, you know, or I have the choice, like, can always pull over and get in my sleeping bag and go to bed, you know? And, I don't know. It's a constant lesson in, being comfortable and content with yourself and your abilities, I guess.
Being here now.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, another trope, but yeah, for sure.
It's true.
It's totally true.
A shorter event, you say, hey, only 1 hour till I get there, only 15 minutes till I get there, only 4 miles till I get there, only 2 miles till I get there. But something like this, you can't really say that. You have to be content.
It's too long.
It's too long. You have to be content with what you're doing now.
Yeah, exactly.
This kind of goes into our whole sports history at a personal level. I used to run a long time ago. People didn't used to see runners, and they yell out the car window, what are you training for? And they always yelled back, this. The question always perplexed me. And it took me a long time to sort it out. I think what they meant is that this isn't supposed to be fun.
Right.
This is supposed to be bad, and you're doing it for another ulterior motive. And that never actually occurred to me. I always doing it because I liked it.
Right, yeah. Now, I mean, obviously that's a frustrating question to anyone who inherently enjoys an activity that is perceived as not fun, but I don't know. I'm not sure how you're using the word fun here, because that's it's another annoyance of mine, I think, in the outdoor world is, or there's sometimes there's this attitude that if it's not fun, why are you doing it? And maybe I'm just being too literal about the way people are using the word fun, because there's a lot of reasons to do something that isn't just like pure hedonism. Because most things aren't, but I think a lot of things are still worth doing, even when they're not, quote unquote, you know, like Ferris wheels and rainbows fun.
Right.
You know?
Edifying or rewarding might be a better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Enriching, fulfilling, satisfying. Yeah,
good. Very good clarification.
Words. But that's what you were when you meant when you said the word fun.
Yes.
Think, you know, and not necessarily training.
Right, right. It's that rather than a means to an end, this is the end.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, because so many people we know, at least I know, who are stellar runners, when they finish their objectives, they quit. They're gone. It's
you mean they're done? They're done being runners. You
yeah.
Mean. Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
My friend Rick Trujillo.
Sure.
Look how many times the guy won Pike's Peak.
Mm-hmm.
He finished second. That's the last time he ran Pike's Peak. It's like, wow, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Arturo Barrios, you know, former world
record. Oh, I heard about this. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Former world record holder in the 10K. He actually went to my garage sale one time. But after he was done, literally at that level, he didn't run again.
Sure.
So this is kind of
Does he still live here in Boulder?
I don't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyways. Yeah, I don't know. It's fine if you have a talent at something and you get a lot of external validation from that, from being, from like expressing that talent. That's just, for me, it's not sustainable, I guess. And,
right.
And it's not the, those aren't the experiences that have a lot of meaning for me, I suppose. And they're not going to, they're not going to be sustaining when no one is paying attention to you anymore.
Right, right. Well, you've kept it up a long time. I mean, it's not that you're old, but you did start young.
I started young, yeah.
Right. So you've been an endurance athlete for a long time. And so obviously, here's a real overused word, but I think it's appropriate, sustainable. You've made this a lifestyle choice. It's working for you professionally and personally.
Sure, yeah.
Which is a big deal. So I think there's some wisdom in this. So I've appreciated how you've defined how you're approaching this.
Yeah, I'm 38. I would hope that I have a number of decades more of like learning to do, but I do feel like that my outlook has evolved on this stuff over the past, call it last 20 years. A lot of it was forced on me. Like my body failed me a lot, and I was like required to adapt and adjust, which is why, I took up things like cycling and climbing and skiing, instead of being just a runner, which I was only a runner for a good 15 years.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, bringing it back, these aren't tangents. This is actually the best part of our conversation, but nonetheless, I'll bring it back. So in episode 127 last year, your quote was, "I don't identify with any one sport. It's about the pure experience." That's still the case. And like I said earlier, you did ski-mo race, you did bike racing, and now with your Sage to Summits, you put biking and running together in a really dramatic way. That's a long trip, 3 weeks, 2,000 miles.
Yeah.
So let's get into this one a little bit. You had to carry some gear because you're going self-supported.
Yeah.
So obviously you were using cleats, real bike shoes because you had to. Then obviously you changed into real running shoes. So you had to carry what, 10 pounds?
Probably close to 15 pounds base weight, actually. 12, maybe 12. Generally I have about, you actually might be right with 10. It's generally about 8. Like base weight, I don't have running equipment with me, but then it's probably another 2 to 3 pounds of running shorts, a cap, shoes, socks, that kind of thing. But stuff, it all ends up adding up a little bit.
The high tech gear.
Yeah.
But when you're going into Granite Peak, that's a long trek. And so
Granite's long, yeah.
So you,
I carried the exact same thing on every mountain. Ultimate Direction makes this little
utility belt.
Yeah, the utility belt. I wear that on every single run. And that was the only quote-unquote pack I brought on the trip.
That's the only? Really? You went all the way into Granite and back?
Granite and Gannett both. Gannett's 13 miles longer than Granite, so.
Wow. Yeah. Just with a utility belt.
Yeah, but I mean, this Buzz, like I've, I'm in a committed long-term relationship. And this was the first kind of trip I've done where I actually had, what do they call them, PLBs, personal location beacon or whatever.
Yes.
At a Garmin Mini InReach.
Good.
That I had on the entire trip and also carried with me on every mountain, which was an absolute first. Like I've done, I did Gannett 10 years ago now.
FKT.
Yeah, it was FKT at the time. And I didn't have something like that. I didn't even have a phone. I had a camera with me. But that wasn't going to be... They were going to triangulate that camera to any cell towers, to find me.
As Aaron Ralston would readily attest, carrying a PLB is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But I was more referring to the volume of that. I mean, you've got like 4 bars. I mean, what can you fit in a utility?
Oh, I wouldn't bring 4 bars. I would usually... I think the most calories I brought with me was 1,500. Sounds about right.
So it's like 7.
What's that?
Well, usually it's about 200 calories per bar.
Oh, 7 bars. Yeah, but I never had bars though. I always had a pack of gas station gummies, which is usually about 900 calories, and then totally blanking. You're right. No, I would have like a granola bar or something. But yeah, that was like on the longest one, 1500 calories. Typically, I would just have like that pack of gummies, and it would be enough usually.
Wow, that's a long day.
But then I would have a water filter too. You know.
Yeah. Use the B-Free.
Yeah, Katahdin.
Right. Right.
I think there's a few others on the market now, but yeah. Right.
I'm just going through the logistics of this, the bike packing and combining it with running. That's remarkable. That's how you kept that weight down. Utility belt's great. I use it a lot, but not for a 16-hour day.
Well, I never had any 16-hour days. My longest day was 10 hours.
You did Gannett in 10 hours round trip?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's cool.
I was trying to get my FKT back, but a rainstorm came in on the way back, and you've done Gannett at least a couple times, I think.
Yep.
And it's mostly boulder field hopping. And when that gets wet, it's very, very treacherous. I'm still injured. Like, I ended up bruising the labrum of my shoulder because I ended up slipping, and that's when I stopped. I was like, I can't try and go fast anymore. And like, I caught myself between two boulders, but just like really jam my...
This is in Tourist Creek, I imagine.
Coming down Tourist Creek, exactly. Yeah. So, anyways, I was on pace to be sub 9 hours.
Really?
Until that. Yeah, until I got to the summit 3 minutes slower than my previous FKT split. So, it was still possible, you know, at that point.
Wow. But doing that in the middle of a big backpacking trip is extremely impressive.
Yeah, well, it was hard at that point because that was day 17, so I was really tired at that point. You know, 17 days without a day off, obviously, but my easiest day was the day before Gannett. I still rode my bike 70 miles over Union Pass, you know, over the Wind River Range to the Green River Lakes Trailhead. I would be remiss to mention, you know, this wasn't completely solo. There are other humans around, obviously, but a friend of mine and photographer Fred Marmsatter, he met me twice on the trip, once on the Grand Teton and then once at the trailhead, the start of and the finish of Gannett, to take photos. So I had that. And I stayed overnight with my sister who lives in Dubois, Wyoming. So, you know, having people you know is absolutely like emotional support along the way. Like, it's hugely uplifting. And I'm not one of those people who really needs a lot of that typically, but a trip like this just like throws it into such stark relief. You're just like, oh yeah, this
3 weeks.
Is the most important thing. Like,
yeah, 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's yeah. And obviously like on the phone with Haley, you know, at least every other day, and so yeah, I don't know. I'm sure where we're going.
that's a fast, very fast Gannett.
Yeah, that was by far the longest. The next longest would have been
Granite,
and that was 6 hours. It was under 7 hours, 6:45, something like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, like that's just a morning, actually. You know, it's like not that long. But it's 25 miles, 26 miles, something like that.
Wow, what a combo. So I have to mention Lachlan Morton.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The Tour de France Alt. And I didn't realize that he really did that. That wasn't a publicity stunt.
Lachlan's for real.
He's for real. He threw down. He had it wasn't his proper bike. And so he got these shin splints early on.
I think it was his knee actually. Yeah.
He got his knee acted up. So he had to throw away his cleats, his road pedals, and he went into a hardware store just to buy some platform pedals.
Yeah.
He couldn't find any, so he bought an entire kid's bike, just a kid's just bike, pedals, yeah. and put the pedals on. And then what was that, like 3,000 miles?
That sounds right. Yeah, because it was the entire Tour de France plus all the transfers between stages. Like, he did the whole thing self-supported.
And self-supported. It was
legit. He was mostly camping out. He, you know, it was, yeah.
And the world.
Well, Lachlan's the real deal for sure.
And the World Pro Tour, if you know this, I mean, most people know this. I mean, you are weighted on hand and foot. It's a massage. It's a
sure.
Cook,
I mean,
it's a chef.
But I mean, in Lachlan, I'm sure Lachlan would agree with this. But like, it's silly to compare the two. They're two completely different endeavors.
Right.
Like, and they're two completely different experiences. One is absolutely just like turning the human into an automaton, basically. Like, like a bicycle riding robot and trying to like optimize for pure human performance. And the other one is like an expeditionary life-changing experience, you know,
and figuring out everything for
yourself. It's a logistical problem solving. Yeah. It's so much more multifaceted. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not to like put either on a different, like say one is better than the other. They're just wildly different. And that, yeah, that's the same with doing like something I did versus, I don't know, say like winning Western States or something. They're two like very different experiences.
Right. Right. Well, I appreciate the way you've been able to do both. This is good. I mean, bike packing is a thing. It's fun. I did my first overnight backpacking trip. Where are we here now? 54 years ago. Oops, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Right. But yeah, bike packing.
So what would have been like about 67 or something? 68?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. Northern Michigan, in fact. You know, that was on my 3-speed Raleigh.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
But it's fun. You know, you're on your own. It's freedom.
Yeah. Well, that's
there's the sense of freedom. See, exactly. Of course, for me, it was seeing mom and dad, and you're off on your own, and you kind of get this feeling, which you know we still have as adults, I think, that I can keep going.
Exactly.
Once you've broke, there's this rubber band that comes up in the first few days, but once you get past that rubber band, it's like I could just keep doing this. This could be my lifestyle. I can do anything I want.
I don't know if it's, for me, it's never like this could be my lifestyle, but it is definitely on shorter trips. And by shorter, I mean like maybe sub 10 days. It's always like, there's always that itch of like, yeah, you could just keep doing this. Like it's sustainable, you know, even if you're doing 100+ miles a day, every day, like it's like, there's something so like you just, you can like focus in and you have a purpose, a very singular, clear, tangible purpose every day, and that's enormously seductive. I think that's what you mean by like I could make this, turn this into a lifestyle.
There's a sense of freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that arises from the realized self-reliance of it, you know. It's like, because it's so much, you feel so out of control of, at least I do, I guess, of things in your day-to-day life so much, of like, oh, there's all these demands being placed on you, people asking you for things, obligations you have. But then when you're out there, you kind of erase all that stuff, and you're so self-contained on the bicycle.
Right.
You have everything you need. It's, I don't know, yeah. It's very freeing. Yeah.
I just thought of that because I just sold my house.
Which one, here in town?
Yeah.
Really?
Oops. Spilled the beans live on the podcast. Yeah. And so I'm down in the basement.
Oh, and they're renting it back to you right now.
And right. No, okay. No. I'm down in the basement, and there's 50 years of stuff.
Oh, you're going through.
50 years of stuff, and you're just working. This is like work, work, work. It's like a week of work.
It's miserable, yeah.
It's miserable.
Yeah.
Other people have had the same experience, and then you're thinking, well, you know, heck, just April, Peter and I were down in the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
We had our 10-pound base weight. We're getting water out of the creeks. That was kind of easy. And now I hear I'm just working my butt off with all this stuff. And it's like, the more objects you have in your life, almost the less you like your life.
Yeah, it's weird. It's, I think it's like those objects are heavier because of all the like emotions and experiences wrapped up in them though too. And I think that stuff is actually important. So it can be like, it can feel cumbersome, but that's also like what makes up a life, I think.
Well, wow. You're right. It is what makes up a life. Otherwise, what do you got?
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Hey, when I was in my first trip overseas to Asia, I met people I was really taken aback by them. It's like, wow, these people are cool. They've been over here for 2 years just traveling around Asia.
Oh, people just kind of like expats. Yeah. Yeah.
They were out on the tourist trail, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I can learn a lot from these guys. Start talking to them. They knew the cheap restaurant, and they knew the cheap hostel.
Yeah.
Didn't know anything. They were boring. It wasn't
interesting. They weren't. Yeah, I see
what you're saying. They didn't have a life. It's like, I'm not getting anything out of this. I don't need to know the cheap hotel. I want to know how we fit into this bigger world and this entire culture.
Yeah. And that, I don't know, and that requires having roots and having a community and that kind of stuff. And I don't know. It's hard to do that as a vagabond, I think.
I think it is. It is. Well, this is fun. I have to... Oh, wait. Before I ask you, which we always do, what's coming next? Mm. Because I know you got a few ideas.
Yeah.
But we have to tie this back in. You did this three-week trip in July.
Mm-hmm.
And then in August, you finished third at Leadville.
I mean,
and not just third, but you were, what was it, within 8 minutes of your best time?
No, I was within an hour of my best time, but it was within 6 minutes of the first time that I did it 15 years ago.
That's it.
Which I won that time. So, I don't know, there was like an eerie kind of like similarity between the very first time I did it and this time when I did it last year.
I was very impressed. I think a lot of people are very impressed. You were 37 years old, which is, you know, not...
38, actually.
Oh, that's right, August.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, you're not an old guy, but 38 is...
Yeah, but it was 15 years after the first time I did it. I
mean, right.
That's a long time, I guess.
Right, and came close on the time, third in a major race, after doing this bikepacking trip. So what's your comments here? It's like... bike packing, riding the bike along with the running? I mean, what are we seeing here?
I think for me, you know, injury management or prevention has always been the real crux of my running career. And biking has allowed me to like maintain and or build fitness, like cardiovascular fitness. And then if I can just get in enough miles to kind of like, you know, season the legs and, I don't know, pepper the musculoskeletal system a little bit to hold up to the rigors of a 100-mile race, and it seems like I can still do okay at it, you know. And this trip that I did on the bike basically was 6 long runs in 3 weeks, you know. So it was a pretty good, like, kickstart to, you know, like, base to the preparations for something like Leadville. Then I did a couple more long runs when I got home and put in a 5-day taper and went and did Leadville.
That worked.
It worked.
No, I'm just trying to figure this out.
I felt good. Like, I felt confident going in. It was mostly the second layer to that was being conservative with my race plan at Leadville, I guess, to because it had been 7 years since I started a 100-mile race. I finished the last one I did, too. But, you know, I hadn't even attempted a 100-mile race in those last 7 years. So it felt really... I wouldn't say brand new, but it felt like scary and uncertain again, which is a fun place to be. You know, that's, I kind of need that spark to have that kind of emotional excitement around it, to have the motivation to drive something as hard as running 100 miles.
And no 220-mile week 2 weeks before.
No, exactly. I think I think my biggest week really all year was maybe like 60 or 70 miles, you know?
Really?
So, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I can't run a lot anymore. My body will break down.
Yeah, but that's like one quarter of your peak week.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Or like a third. Yeah, yeah.
Dang. Okay. All right. So there's some takeaways here, I think. And we interviewed Anna Troop from the UK who got FKT of the Year number 3 for Pennine Way. Hmm. She's 53 years old. I said, wow, hey, that's good. She's by far the oldest FKT of the Year award winner.
Yeah.
I said, so any thoughts on that? She said, I do my hard work on the bike. So she runs for the biomechanics.
Yeah.
But she hits it hard on the bike because in her body...
In terms of intensity, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Huh.
Because as you know, you can just hit it on the bike. Next day, you're fine.
Yeah, you can get really cardiovascularly fit on the bicycle. But for ultramarathon running, there's a certain amount of conditioning that your skeleton and musculature needs in order to be able to withstand it.
Right.
But it's not as, you know, especially, you know, I've been running long distances for over 25 years now. You know, I did my first marathon, 26 years ago. So I have a big lifetime base of that kind of muscular conditioning, I guess.
Gotcha. Okay, well, good call on that. So you're a great cyclist. I mean, you're not top 50.
I ride my bike a lot. I don't know if I'm a great cyclist.
I know. You said top 50%. You're more like top 10 or 20% of the field.
Maybe. I don't even know. Yeah.
And then obviously, somehow, and I'm like this too, because I've done some kayak racing, and I've seen a paddleboard racing, bike racing, et cetera, et cetera. I'm still a better runner.
Sure.
Which is it mystifies me because I can run like once or twice a week and just train the bike, train the boat, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. But I never get to the same level I was at in running.
That's my exact position right now. Yeah.
Isn't that odd?
Like if I were 25 years old right now, looking at 38-year-old me, I would be really pissed at 38-year-old me because I'd be like, this dude doesn't even run and he's able to like podium at a race like Leadville. I would be a little angry with me. But I have put a lot of miles in my legs, and I think the same is true for you, over the last, 55 years.
Yep.
So,
I've got a base.
Yeah.
So what is next? I know you got some cool projects. You might not want to spill the beans on them, but
because they're still in formation. But I mean, immediately next is this spring. There's a couple of biking specific things I want to do. Haley and I are heading out to SoCal in a couple weeks to just do this kind of casual bike packing tour in Southern California. It's called the Stagecoach Route. But then later in the spring, we might do something a little higher intensity. Maybe an ITT on a bike packing loop somewhere. But I also want to, I'd like to do like a 50 miler or something this spring on foot.
50's good.
Yeah, just because it's like, it keeps me in touch with going long, but it's not, you can recover in a week,
Right.
And then when summer comes around, the first half will be devoted to some kind of big project involving biking and foot travel probably. Mm-hmm. And then I might go back to Leadville. I don't know. We'll see.
Interesting. Leadville, because Leadville kind of fell off the map a little bit when Hard Rock demoted it from a qualifying race.
Yeah.
But you still like the course? You still like...
I have so much history with it at this point. That's the most important connection to it for me, I guess, is it's just kind of like this touchstone, like in my personal identity, I suppose. That is comfortable in a way, but also really meaningful. The most logistical thing is it's 2 hours from where we live here in Boulder.
Right.
And my main sponsor, La Sportiva, is also a sponsor of Leadville. So I have that. And this is not a small thing in today's ultra-running world. I can get in whenever I want, basically. So I can't say that about almost any other 100-mile race. So limiting that way.
Yeah, UTMB isn't Paletti's and aren't going to say, "Hey, Tony, come on over."
Yeah. So
gotcha. Well, that's true, and I like the logistics aspect. The travel thing is a little odd, and so Leadville, you just shoot on up there and.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. We're still in a pandemic. It's hard to make plans that involve international travel still, I think. But
gotcha.
By the summer, that'll probably be
fine. But I like this. This is a mix, a little bit of racing, a little bit of riding, and the combo pack. Any thoughts on what that big combination trip might be? This is because your Sagebrush Summits trip, that was very creative. You got six summits, six classic ranges, the highest peak. Yeah. That was a good route.
Yeah, I was happy with the... I guess the itinerary of that, and that it was usually like 2 days of biking in between a mountain, that kind of thing. I mean, the 14ers in Colorado are an obvious one to do, self-powered. 14ers in California don't interest me as much because they're just clumped. It's like there's not a lot of biking going on. Like you have Shasta, then you ride your bike a long ways to the Sierra and you do all this. It's not a lot of bike riding.
But they're nice summits.
Yeah, I think they're very worthy mountains to like spend time in, but I don't think it makes sense to include a bicycle. But then you start looking at the Cascades and the volcanoes up there, starting with Baker in the north all the way down to Lawson Peak in the south. That starts looking like a logical link up of some kind, but I've never been to the Cascades, so that's a huge unknown for me.
Those volcanoes stand out. I mean,
we were on one,
you look to the south, and there's the others. You look to the north, and they're just lined up in a row.
I know. It's very compelling. We were actually just out in Seattle last week before. We have a sponsor out there, and you're flying, leaving Seattle, and like you fly right past Rainier, and you look down, and it's like, oh, there's Adams, there's Hood. It's just like, like you said, it's just like boop, 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 just lined up perfect. And it was really cool then, because they were all just like poking above the clouds, too, but... I just don't, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that one because I have no experience in the Northwest.
So, right. Yeah. They got snow.
Snow, and there's trees, and there's rain. And I mean, I've spent a lot of time on snow, but just the whole landscape feels very foreign to me. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So
nice. Well, thank you for taking your time. This is an edifying conversation. It's so thoughtful. I mean, your athletic accomplishments are well known. What you did this last year is stellar.
I didn't even mention. I was just thinking about how this is the FKT podcast. The first peak I did was an FKT Kings Peak.
Oh.
In the Uintas, yeah. But I mean, that's here and there. People can go on the website if they want to look at that.
The first peak you did on your Sagebrush to Summit was Kings Peak, and you got an FKT on that.
Yeah.
And that's after biking to get there for 2 days.
3 days.
3 days.
Yeah, 440 miles or something, yeah.
Well, you have serious endurance.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, sure. Okay, well, thanks again for taking your time, and congratulations on a stellar 2021.
Thanks, Buzz, yeah.
And not only do we look forward to what happens this year, but we look forward to that book. You're a thoughtful, intelligent person.
Thanks, Buzz. I just need to get more disciplined, I guess, and actually start writing it.
Take care.
Thanks, Buzz.